The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, here we have our outline of Greek philosophy. I was talking to you yesterday about Parmenides, the second of the three Eleatic philosophers. Parmenides, as you remember, begins by saying whatever the mind thinks of must exist, and whatever exists must be known by the mind, so that there's a perfect correspondence between thought and reality. This is the rationalistic premise that we've seen that Dr. Van Til finds in all non-Christian philosophy. The assumption that there must always be a correspondence between everything in the mind and everything in reality, that nothing can be truly unknowable. Whatever exists must be known, whatever is known must exist, a correspondence between thought and being. Now, this raises a tremendous problem with non-being. If there's this correspondence between thought and being, what are you going to do about things that don't exist? And as I described to you yesterday, Parmenides finds it even difficult to conceive of anything that does not exist. He finds that a virtually self-contradictory concept. And so he develops a philosophy with the explicit intention of eliminating all reference to non-being, eliminating all reference to nothing, eliminating anything that doesn't measure up to his standard of being. Well, he discovers that the concept of change involves non-being, and so therefore there can be no change, and so on and on we go. Being is changeless. Being is ungenerated, it's indestructible, changeless, homogeneous, continuous, that is, it has no parts, perfect, motionless, and limited. The world as it really is has all of those characteristics according to Parmenides. Now, the main trouble with this is that no matter how rational it sounds, it simply is not the world that we live in. The world that we live in does have change. The world that we live in has plurality as well as unity. It's not simply one, as Parmenides' being is one. Our world contains motion. Our world contains all of these things that Parmenides says doesn't exist. Now, how are we going to deal with that problem? Well, Parmenides' basic answer is that all of these things are illusions, that change is an illusion, plurality is an illusion, the parts of things are illusions, there really are no parts, imperfection is an illusion, motion is an illusion, and so on and so forth. But that really doesn't help very much, you see, because if reality is what Parmenides says it is, if reality is really changeless and so on, then how can there be any illusions? Where does the illusion arise? How can there be even the illusion of change? Because in the world that Parmenides speaks of, you can't even distinguish between illusion and reality. All distinctions are wiped out. All is one. There is no distinction to be made between one thing and another thing. There's only one thing. There can be no distinction between illusion and reality. So what are we going to do about this problem of illusion? Here we find an irrational streak coming into Parmenides' thought. Now, Parmenides is generally considered about the most rationalistic of the rationalists. If anyone has tried to be rationalistic, it's Parmenides. If anybody has tried to achieve a perfect correspondence between thought and reality, it's Parmenides. But at this point, Parmenides is in a bind. Parmenides cannot account for this illusion. And so what happens? Well, the goddess rescues him here. The goddess comes and gives him a new revelation. This is, very often the goddesses of this world come and give us new revelations when we're in a spot. And the goddess tells him that if he's too bothered by this problem of illusion, he can adopt another philosophy, an alternative philosophy, which is not really true, but nevertheless it will help him get along in this world of illusion. And this untrue philosophy, this secondary philosophy, is a philosophy with two principles in it. Not just one principle, but two. And these two principles are light and darkness, fire and darkness, or various names for the two principles. They oppose one another. They produce change, they produce motion, they produce conflict, they produce all of the diversity that we have in our experience, and so on and so forth. And the goddess says, all right, Parmenides, as you live in this world of illusion, you can live in terms of the second philosophy. Well, you see what's happening here. Parmenides has started off trying to be a rationalist, trying to have a perfect correspondence between thought and reality. He discovers, though, that that can't be done, that he can't live in the world that he's created that way, and he cannot even defend that particular world because the problem of illusion is too great a problem for that philosophy to handle. So in order to avoid all of those problems, he jumps into mythology. He jumps into, he simply admits, in effect, the bankruptcy of his original position. And he jumps into a second philosophy, which he admits is irrational, which he admits has no grounding in reality, which he admits is purely illusory, and yet, nevertheless, he needs it in order to live in the world. So you see how this program of rationalism is so easily frustrated. It turns into a kind of skepticism, a mad leap into mythology, an irrational leap into something which, by definition, in Parmenides' philosophy, is absurd. All right, now, other philosophers naturally were not satisfied with Parmenides' attempt, and so in the next three categories here, we have various people who attempted to present alternatives I don't want to sound like they all were reacting to Parmenides, although perhaps they were to some extent, but presenting alternative approaches anyway to the type of approach that Parmenides set forth. Heraclitus, the atomists, and the sophists. Now, Heraclitus is famous for saying that everything flows, ponta re, the Greek phrase, everything flows, nothing remains, ponta re udamine. You cannot step in the same river twice is one of the vivid ways in which he expressed this kind of notion. He's often looked upon as basically an irrationalist because of this emphasis on flux, because of this emphasis on the changing character of reality. In a sense, he starts off in the opposite way from Parmenides. Heraclitus says, look, obviously everything is changing, everything is in motion, nothing is the same from one moment to the next. And so, if you're going to do justice to this world, you can't start out like Parmenides and say that change does not exist. Why, change is the most obvious feature of the world in which we live. Everything is constantly changing, and if you're going to do justice to the world, you have to do justice to that feature. The ultimacy of change would be kind of a slogan if you want to characterize the thought of Heraclitus, or Dr. Van Til is fond of the phrase, all is flux, to again get that all is, which is so common to the pre-Socratic philosophers. However, there's another side to Heraclitus. Heraclitus is not purely and simply a philosopher of change. You see, if everything flows, if nothing remains the same, then how can you characterize it at all? How can you describe it at all? If everything flows, then the fact of change itself, at least, is something constant. If you say that everything flows, then flowing is something that everything does. And flowing is something that happens all the time. So the flowing is something constant, isn't it? Change itself is something constant. Change itself is a kind of universal category by which we can bring all reality together and say at least all reality has this in common, it changes. So there's a kind of rationalistic side to Heraclitus's thought. Heraclitus, in fact, felt that he was following the demands of reason in all of this. Heraclitus felt that he was following the concerns of philosophy, of philosophers before him, to come up with a rational account of the world. Now, this is particularly noticeable in his doctrine of the Logos. Heraclitus is probably the first philosopher to make use of the term Logos in a philosophically or theologically important sense. Heraclitus saw the Logos as that rational principle which governed the process of change. You see, in Heraclitus's thought, change is not just something that happens chaotically, something that happens randomly. Change is under a kind of rational direction. Change is under the dominion of a kind of rational principle in the universe. Now, what are you going to say about that? Well, I've maintained that there's a kind of irresolvable tension in Heraclitus. I don't think that Heraclitus has done justice to the structure of the world any more than Parmenides has. Heraclitus starts at the opposite direction from Parmenides, but he has the same problem of rationalism versus irrationalism that you find in Parmenides. Heraclitus starts off by saying everything flows, everything changes. But then it turns out that no, not everything changes. At least change itself is something constant. Change, in fact, is something that can be charted. It's something that can be described intelligibly. You can even say that it's governed by a rational principle, which you can describe as the Logos. Well, that compromises, I think, Heraclitus's initial principle that everything changes, because if everything changed, then there would be no possibility of giving a rational account of reality at all. What you say about reality at one moment would be changed into the opposite the next moment, and something else would happen. But nevertheless, Heraclitus is committed, I think, by his non-Christian presuppositions, to saying that he has the last word about what is true and what is false, and that last word must be taken account of, and that's reflected in the doctrine of the Logos, the idea that although change is constant, nevertheless the mind of man is capable of saying that and of describing the process of change. But what basis is there for saying that if everything changes? So again, you have that reciprocity, each side compromising the other side. Now, the atomists, D on the outline here, the atomists, don't write down animists on your papers the way one student did. The atomists take another kind of approach. Remember, Parmenides had said that being was one. Parmenides can be called a monist. A monist is one who believes that there's only one principle, one basic principle of explanation in the universe. Or a monist would be somebody who believes that all reality is basically one thing, that everything, all the differences that seem to be different in our experience really boil down to one single unity, one single principle. Now, the atomists, on the other hand, are pluralists. They're pluralists. Now, philosophers, when they try to... what happened? Oh, amen. Okay. Yeah, I say that too. Philosophers, when they and try to examine the structure of the world traditionally go in one of two directions. The monistic direction goes as follows. You look at the world and you say, now how am I going to understand this chair? Well, I can't understand the chair unless I understand its larger context, unless I understand the room in which it functions, unless I understand something about people who sit in the chair. After all, the chair is designed for people, and I have to know something about the materials from which it comes. And in order to know about them, I have to know something about the structure of the world and the minerals and the chemistry and the physics, and I have to know everything there is to know. Eventually, you say, in order to understand that chair, I have to know the whole universe. That's the kind of rationalistic principle that leads you to conclude the necessity of exhaustive knowledge. In order to understand the chair, you have to know the whole of reality. The chair is meaningless apart from a total context. And that, of course, is what leads monists to say reality is basically one thing. Chairs can't be understood in themselves, only the totality of being can be understood in itself. Now there's an opposite way of proceeding. And the opposite way is to say, well, we have this chair here, how am I going to understand it? Well, I have to kind of chop it up and find out what it's made of. I have to determine what its constituent parts are. And so you chop it, take off the arms, and you take off the legs, and you take off the back, and so on and so forth. Well, how am I, now I'm sitting here with the chair leg in my hand. How do I understand that? Well, you find out what that's made of. You chop it up into smaller parts. Eventually, you get smaller and smaller things. Eventually, you get molecules. And how are you going to understand a molecule? Well, you have to break that up still more and into atoms. And how are you going to understand the atoms? Well, you break that up into subatomic particles, and you explain it that way, and on and on and on and on. That's the direction of the pluralist. The pluralist is somebody who tries to break up reality into its constituent parts, that tries to find the smallest principles possible to explain all things. Now, if you're a non-Christian, of course, you're going to want to move in an unlimited way, whichever direction you select. If you're a monist, you're not going to stop until you've charted the whole universe, because you demand exhaustive knowledge. If you're a pluralist, you're not going to stop until you've got every single principle, every single little particle in the universe, and you've charted its nature, and so on and so forth. Now, the atomists are the first pluralists. The atomists, Democritus, being the earliest of them. Democritus lived about 460 to 370, I believe. Epicurus was considerably later. Lucretius was a Latin poet who lived in the first century BC, but followed in general the Epicurean system. The atomists maintained that reality can be divided into small particles, indestructible particles. Now these particles have some of the properties of Parmenidean being. They can't be divided further. They're hard. They're indestructible. They have no parts. They do move, however. They are matter in motion. And all of the changes that we see in the world are the products of matter in motion, these atoms moving throughout the universe at different rates of speed and so on. Epicurus found that the original Democritean view did not leave much room for human freedom, did not leave much room for human choice. If all things happen as the result of atoms moving around at a constant speed, what room is there for human responsibility? What room is there, in fact, for the function of human reason? How can one reason be better than another if it's simply the product of different atoms moving around in my brain in some way or other? That's getting back to Thales, all is water. How can one wave be more valid than another wave? So Epicurus developed a little addition to this system. He said that when the atoms fall down, generally in a vertical direction, every now and then one of them swerves from the vertical. Just kind of irrationally swerves from the vertical. There's nothing that makes it do it. It just, you know, completely unpredictable. It just swerves. It's that swerve that makes the atoms bump into one another. It's that swerve which accounts for the development of the universe. It's that swerve which produces things, produces elements, which produces animals, which produces men eventually. And it's also that swerve which accounts for human freedom, because every once in a while the atoms of your body will swerve. And at that point, you make free choices. At that point, you make free decisions. You also are able to have the freedom to make intellectual evaluations. Well, you see, again, the tension between rationalism and irrationalism here. You start off with a rationalistic scheme. You're trying to find the ultimate constituents of reality. When you find that, you discover that the system imperils your own reason from which you started out, so you develop various schemes in order to rehabilitate reason, schemes which, as a matter of fact, only call it into question further. The fact that my atoms swerve certainly doesn't guarantee the rationality of anything that I say to you, quite to the contrary. Nor does it guarantee the freedom and the responsibility and the significance of the choices I make from a moral point of view. All right, the next group would be the sophists, of which Protagoras is the example. You can read about Protagoras in Plato's dialogue with that title. The sophists maintain that there is no universal truth at all. Now, you see how this differs from Parmenides. The sophists, I think, can be fairly described as starting off with a fairly irrationalistic premise, that there is no universal truth at all. Well, you can understand what the arguments for this would be. If you're standing in a room here, some of you will feel hot and some of you will feel cold. Well, is the room hot or is it cold? Can we take a vote on that and determine it? That would be kind of silly. The fact is that it's hot to some and cold to others. There's no such thing as objective hotness or objective coldness. It's cold to those who feel that it's cold, and it's hot to those who feel that it's hot. The same thing with regard to colors. Something will look green to one person and look blue to another person. Well, is it green or is it blue? All you can say is that it's green to the one who sees it as green, and it's blue to the one who sees it as blue. And on you go. All experiences taken in different ways. So there is no universal truth. Truth is only truth for a particular individual. A statement can be true only for me. It's not true for everybody. It's true only for me at a particular time. This is the origin of philosophical relativism, the idea that there is no universal, unchanging truth. There's only truth for a particular person at a particular moment of time. Now, this sounds like a very irrationalistic view, and it's very often refuted, you see, by those who they'll use arguments like the following. You say that there is no universal truth. Do you know that that's true? Okay? Is that a universal truth? And that's supposed to refute the skeptic. The skeptic is supposed to say, well, yes, I believe that that's universally true. And then you've refuted his skepticism, and you can go on from there. Well, that doesn't always work, you know. You might find one of these skeptics, and you might come up and say, well, do you believe that skepticism is universally and absolutely true? He would say no. And then what do you do? well, skepticism is really much harder to refute than it appears to be at first glance. A person can keep, evading the question. But I think the real problem for the skeptic is that it's found, for instance, in Protagoras' statement that man is the measure of all things. Now, this is can be seen from one point of view as an implication of his relativism, If you're going to hold a relativistic philosophy, you have to say, well, everybody is the measure of truth. Everybody measures his own truth. There is nothing, there are no criteria for truth external to ourselves to which we must bow down. Truth is what we make of it. Truth is what we say it is. That would seem to follow from his rationalism, but at the same time, it rather contradicts his rationalism. It contradicts his irrationalism, because he's, when you think about that statement, it really is a very irrational, a very rationalistic thing to say, because you're claiming that you know all the truth that there is. You're claiming that you are the final judge of what is true and what is false. You're claiming that whatever can be said, you have the resources to determine the validity of that statement. So really, although this seems like a very modest kind of philosophy, although it seems to be claiming to have very little knowledge, it's really claiming to have a great deal. It's really making a very arrogant, very rationalistic type of judgment about the nature of truth. You see then that now here are three systems: Heraclitus, the atomists, and the sophists, all trying to avoid the problems of Parmenides. Heraclitus wants to get away from the changelessness of Parmenides' system and admit that there's change. The atomists want to get away from this monism. They want to say reality is not one, reality is many. Sophists want to get away from the rationalism of Parmenides. They want to say there is no universal, absolute truth that's binding upon all people. But you see, even when these three types of thinkers try to get away from Parmenides' system, they find themselves trapped in the same problems that Parmenides experienced. And their positions on the whole, although they raise a lot of interesting questions and present a lot of interesting arguments, their positions as a whole are no better than the position of Parmenides. Well, the time has come then for an approach that's far more sophisticated than any of the approaches that we've seen so far. All of the philosophers that we've talked about so far, A, B, C, D, and E, can be called pre-Socratics. Pre-Socratics, because they all come before Socrates. Socrates, of course, was a very remarkable individual. He wrote no books. There's nothing that's attributed to his hand. However, he seems to have made an incredible impact upon his world and upon the thinkers, particularly in his world, by his personal teaching. Evidently, he went around from place to place, engaging in the conversations with people, probing them, asking them tough questions, getting them to question their own dogmatisms, getting them to change their positions by thinking through problems. And so you have the Socratic method of teaching that's often advocated even today, and a very good method it is, too, for the most part. Socrates' philosophy is very difficult to determine, because we know about it only through his disciple Plato and from a few other sources like Xenophon's Memorabilia and so on. Apparently, so it's very difficult to separate out what Socrates thought from what Plato thought. From all we can determine, the main idea of Socrates seemed to be that knowledge is virtue, that the more knowledge you can get, the better off you are. And the main problem in knowledge, of course, is to know yourself, to be aware of your own strengths and your own limitations, to know what you can know and what you can't know, having known yourself, to be able to tackle the great problems of knowledge. The inquiry seems to be more important than the finished product. The method of trying to achieve this enlightenment is more important than the conclusions which one actually comes to. But the quest of knowledge is, to Socrates, a tremendously exciting thing, and he evidently was able to imbue his disciples with a tremendous vision for for philosophy, for getting to know, for asking the questions about the basic issues of life. Now, Plato is the foremost disciple of Socrates, at least the most important one that's had an impact upon later thinking. Plato develops a very remarkable synthesis, which has influenced philosophers right on down to the present day. Even today, there are philosophers who, in various ways, can be classified as Platonic. Plato is faced with these two drives, these two driving principles of rationalism and irrationalism. And he feels all the tensions that we've talked about, and he's trying to find some way to resolve this particular group of tensions. Here's a little diagram that I've come up with, which is terribly simplistic, but it'll help you perhaps to see a little bit about, to visualize perhaps some of Plato's positions. Plato is impressed with a lot of Parmenides' arguments, and he's also impressed with the arguments of Heraclitus. Plato is convinced that you need some kind of stability if you're going to have knowledge at all. You need some changeless reality to which knowledge can refer if you're going to have knowledge at all. He believes that there has to be something more than mere opinion, which the sophists, of course, seem to reduce knowledge to opinion. On the other hand, he's also convinced that there's plenty of change going on in the world. He doesn't want to eliminate change. He doesn't want to make it an illusion the way Parmenides did. He's also convinced that there is particularity in the world. He doesn't want to remove all distinctions between things the way Parmenides did. And he's also convinced that there is a realm of opinion as well as a realm of knowledge. He wants to have one realm in human thought where we can claim that we have genuine knowledge, just as Parmenides did. But he also wants to argue that there are areas of human thinking, some types of human thinking, which don't reach up that far, which don't achieve that high level of knowledge that can only be called opinion. Well, how are you going then to reconcile all of these concerns with one another? Well, you do it by setting up a cosmology of two different worlds. Two different worlds. We live, you might say, in the world of sensation. We live, you might say, down here. These are the things that we experience. We experience triangles when we study geometry. We experience trees when we look out in the fields. We experience other people. All of these things are items of our experience. But Plato realizes that in this world, there's really no certain knowledge of these things that we experience. He's impressed with the sophists' arguments here. One person will feel hot, another person will feel cold. One person will look at something and say that it's blue, somebody else will look at it and say that it's green. Our senses deceive us all the time. We have all kinds of problems in determining what is real, and so it seems almost as though there's no knowledge, only opinion. That would be the sophist's conclusion, but Plato doesn't want to go that far, because Plato recognizes that we have ways of correcting our misunderstandings. We do have ways of determining what is true. Okay, so the stick, as it gets into the water, appears to be bent. But you can find out that stick is not really bent, that it's really a straight stick. You find out by taking it out of the water. You find out by examining the properties of water and the properties of light. You find out by exercising your reason. You find out by thinking. You find out by a process of meticulous examination, as Socrates taught us to examine our lives. The unexamined life is not worth living. So we seem to have some kind of knowledge that enables us to correct our mistakes. We seem to have some kind of knowledge that by definition is certain. It's sure, because if it corrects our mistakes, then of course that kind of knowledge has to have access to certainty. If that kind of knowledge itself is fallible, then of course the sophists are right. There's no hope. But if there is any knowledge, if you can say anything is true, then there must be some access to some knowledge that's infallible. Now, where do we get that infallible knowledge? Well, there's a dialogue of Plato called the Meno, M-E-N-O, M-E-N-O, where you have a master and a slave, and the slave looks, the slave is brought in, he has no education particularly, he has no experience with mathematical concepts, but the master draws a few pictures in the dust of geometrical objects, and the slave looks at the pictures, and the master and Socrates ask him questions about the figures. And lo and behold, the slave somehow comes up with the right answers. He comes up with the right answers to these geometric problems, even though he hasn't studied geometry. And of course, he hasn't been given any geometrical information. He's just been answering questions the whole time. And so the conclusion is, well, you can do this yourself. Hold up two fingers and two more and look at them. And somebody says, well, you have two fingers here, you have two fingers here. How many total? And you look at them and you say four. Isn't that amazing that you figured that out on your own, even though you've never learned it, perhaps? Well, that's what goes on with Meno's slave. He just seems to get these answers out of his head somewhere. Where do they come from? He's had no education. He's had no sophistication. How does he know these things? Well, certainly he doesn't know them through his sense experiences, because sense experiences is undependable. Where does he get them? Well, Plato reasons it can't have come in this life. It must have come in another life. He must be recalling. He must be remembering something that he learned somewhere else. And so Plato's formula, knowledge is reminiscence. Knowledge is reminiscence. Knowledge is remembering something that you already know. And where did we know all of these things? Well, it seems that there's another world, the world of ideas, or the world of forms. In the world of forms, you find perfect examples of everything that is imperfectly found here on this earth. For instance, in the world of forms, there's a perfect triangle. Now, none of the triangles that you find in this world are perfect triangles. There's always a little bit of, somebody's pen will slip, and there'll be a little hook in the line, and there are no perfect triangles here in this world. But somehow, you know, we have this knowledge of a perfect triangle. We know what a perfect triangle would be. We know how the angles, we know what the sum total of the angles would be. We know how the lines would be related to one another. We can construct various formulae, which obtain with perfect triangles. Now, where do we get that concept of a perfect triangle? Not from our life here on Earth, from reminiscence, from remembering this world of the forms in which we once lived. And so in the world of the forms, you have perfect exemplars. You have perfect criteria. You have perfect standards for everything that we have here in this world. The forms have the characteristics of Parmenidean being. They are uncreated. They are indestructible. They are knowable. They are perfectly knowable through the use of the intellect. They are basic principles in our knowledge. They are not composed of parts. They are and so on and so forth. They take on many of the characteristics of Parmenidean being, many of the characteristics of deity, so that the forms then form the basis of knowledge. And it's knowledge of the forms which gives us the infallibility that we need in order to construct the whole fabric of knowledge. Now, what is the relationship between the world of forms and the world in which we live? Now, that's one of the major problems in Plato. That's a difficult thing for Plato to explain. In the dialogue called the Timaeus, he explains in somewhat mythological terms how the world that we live in is derived from the world of forms. Here's the myth, and I'm not sure how seriously Plato is taking this, but it seems to be about the best that he can do in showing the relationship between the world of forms and the world of experience. You have a quasi-divine being, a divine being which in the dialogue is called the Demiurge, the Demiurgos. The Demiurge is a kind of deity. He's not an infinite deity. He's not an all-powerful deity like the God of Christianity. He's a finite deity. He's limited by the material with which he works. The Demiurge lives in the world of forms, and he goes down to produce a world which is somehow a copy of the world of forms. He takes various materials and he forms them so that they resemble the world of forms. However, he cannot do this perfectly. He's resisted by the material with which he works. The material cannot perfectly reproduce the world of forms. So you find in this world then imperfect triangles, imperfect trees, imperfect men, and so on and so forth. The problem is has to do with this, which in Greek, kora, sometimes translated place, sometimes also referred to in Plato's Timaeus as the receptacle. The Demiurge has to have something to work with. He has to have a place to put his creation. And the place has characteristics of its own somehow. The place resists the formation process that the Demiurge is trying to place upon it. It resists the forms. It will not allow itself to be perfectly formed. Now, this concept here is a very difficult concept, a very strange concept. Kora is, by definition, something that is unformed. By very definition, it's something that has no form itself. It's not itself a copy of anything in the world of forms or the world of ideas. It's unformed. It is what receives form. It is that which receives the creative work of the Demiurge. But nevertheless, it appears that it's because of this kora, it's because of this place, it's because of this receptacle that the Demiurge is hindered. It's because of that receptacle that the forms cannot be perfectly reproduced in this world. So evidently, kora must have some characteristics. It must have some qualities. It must have some power to resist formation. And yet it's a power which is totally irrational. It's a power which cannot be described in terms of the forms. It's a power, power of formlessness. So that, as it turns out in Plato, the forms do not explain all of the characteristics of the world in which we live. See, this is the problem for Plato. He sets up the world of forms so that he can have a rational explanation for everything that takes place in this world. But it turns out that the forms will not provide that rational explanation because the forms do not give account of the ways in which they are resisted by the world. For instance, just to give some examples, come down from the abstract a little bit, here you have all these imperfect triangles, okay? Now, how can you come to a rational understanding of those triangles? Plato says You come to a rational understanding of them by remembering the concept of perfect triangularity that you knew when you lived in the world of forms. Now, the trouble is that concept of perfect triangularity doesn't give you any help with the imperfections, all right? It doesn't explain the imperfections. It doesn't tell you how this triangle differs from that triangle. It doesn't tell you how the properties vary between two things of the same species. The forms themselves can give you only abstract characteristics. They can only give you the characteristics that things have in common with one another. And if the world of forms is taken of as being the exhaustive explanation for all things, then the world of forms, and if the world of forms provides the only rationality there is, then there's an awful lot of irrationality in the world. There's an awful lot that can't be explained. And the forms themselves are put in jeopardy because the forms do not dictate exhaustively the properties which you will find in the world as you explore it. So the forms are inadequate explanations because the forms are being resisted constantly by this material principle, by this principle of place, this principle of the receptacle. This is what limits the power of God. The God, the demiurge, is limited in power. The forms are limited in their power of explanation. And this matter, this what Aristotle called matter, I sometimes use the term matter here, this place, this receptacle, this matter becomes a great mystery. It becomes something that really you shouldn't even talk about. It's the nothing. It's the irrational principle. It's the upper corner of the square. It's the upper right-hand corner of the square. It's that nothing which can't be described, which can't be talked about, and yet somehow you must talk about it, because it has characteristics that have to be taken into account. And so the nothing opposes the reality, and you're thrown into a sea then of irrationalism. I'd say that Plato in general tries to be a rationalist, but you see there are these elements in his view which force him to recognize the incapacities of reason and which really relativize the answers that he tries to give to the problems with which he deals. Yes. Well, scholars debate as to whether there's a one-to-one correspondence between Plato's kora and Aristotle's matter. I think that they both have the same function, approximately, and they have the same problems attached to it. Thing is that the term matter has connotations, you know, that go beyond the connotations of the term place. Aristotle's matter is not just a location. It seems to have something more than that, although it's very difficult to distinguish the two, because once you try to distinguish them, you have to say something about them. And once you say something about them, you're talking about forms, not about matter. Yeah. Yes, yes. Well, see, on the one hand, there can't be, because the forms have to explain everything. So the forms have to be adequate to explain all the diversity. On the other hand, there must be, because the forms are resisted. The forms do not cover all of the particularities and distinctiveness. So, you know, there are reasons in Plato for answering both ways. That's part of the problem there. Yep. Oh, yes, they were. Parmenides certainly was. Yes, exactly. I think that's what's going on in the all is water, all is air, all is... you know, trying to make statements about the whole of reality without leaving anything out. And if you're going to do that, then, you know, the slightest problem, the slightest failure in your system is going to invalidate the whole. Yes? Right, right. Other questions? Yes?
There's only supposed to be, you know, one form for each particular thing that we perceive in terms of this world. In terms of a triangle, isn't that three lines? So then you would have a form line, and then the three lines that compose a triangle. So you have four lines in the form. Now that can't be, can it?
Well, the This is another whole range of problems, you know. How are the forms structured? People used to ask Plato, are there forms of mud, hair, and filth in the real world? That's a trick question for Plato, because filth is really a kind of formlessness, you know. It's a kind of deprivation of form. It's a kind of perversion of form. And Plato really didn't want to say that there were forms of such things, but on the other hand, if the forms are going to furnish complete explanations, that they're going to guarantee rationality, then there have to be forms of everything. So there are elements in Plato that make him want to say that there are forms of everything, and there are also elements which lead him to want to say that some forms are subordinate to others, and it becomes kind of complicated in the totality of its. Okay, we'll have a lunchtime seminar at 1 o'clock today. Carl, did you have a question? I'm sorry?
I don't understand why he has so much trouble with the power of formlessness. All you have to do is say, well, it's there, whatever it is there. No.
Well, if you're trying to get exhaustive knowledge, you see, if you're trying to have a scheme that explains all of reality, then you can't tolerate formlessness.
And